Chapter 38. Square with that woman, when you've had the power in your hands. She continued silent under the rush of astonishment that his words produced, and he moved a step closer to ask with low-toned directness, why don't you use those letters of hers you bought last year? Lily stood speechless under the shock of the interrogation. And the words preceding it, as he had conjectured, at most, an allusion to her supposed influence over George Dorset, nor did the astonishing indelicacy of the reference diminish the likelihood of Rosedale's resorting to it. But now she saw how far short of the mark as he had fallen, and the surprise of learning that he had discovered the secret of the letters left her, for the moment, unconscious of the special use to which he was in the act of putting his knowledge. Her temporary loss of self-possession gave him time to press his point, and he went on quickly, as though to secure completer control of the situation, you see I know where you stand, I know how completely she's in your power. That sounds like stage talk, don't it? But there's a lot of truth in some of those old gags, and I don't suppose you bought those letters simply because you're collecting autographs. She continued to look at him with a deepening bewilderment. Her only clear impression resolved itself into a scared sense of his power. You're wondering how I found out about him? He went on, answering her look with a note of conscious pride. Perhaps you've forgotten that I'm the owner of the Benedict, but never mind about that now. Getting onto things is a mighty useful accomplishment in business, and I've simply extended it to my private affairs. For this is partly my affair, you see, at least, it depends on you to make it so. Let's look the situation straight in the eye. Mrs. Dorset, for reasons we needn't go into, did you a beastly bad turn last spring. Everybody knows what Mrs. Dorset is, and her best friends wouldn't believe her on oath, where their own interests were concerned. But as long as they're out of the row, it's much easier to follow her lead than to set themselves against it, and you've simply been sacrificed to their laziness and selfishness. Isn't that a pretty fair statement of the case? Well, some people say you've got the neatest kind of an answer in your hands. That George Dorset would marry you tomorrow, if you'd tell him all you know, and give him the chance to show the lady the door. I dare say he would, but you don't seem to care for that particular form of getting even, and, taking a purely business view of the question, I think you're right. In a deal like that, nobody comes out with perfectly clean hands, and the only way for you to start fresh is to get Bertha Dorset to back you up, instead of trying to fight her. He paused long enough to draw breath, but not to give her time for the expression of her gathering resistance, and as he pressed on, expounding and elucidating his idea with the directness of the man who has no doubts of his cause, she found the indignation gradually freezing on her lip, found herself held fast in the grasp of his argument by the mere cold strength of its presentation. There was no time now to wonder how he had heard of her obtaining the letters. All her world was dark outside the monstrous glare of his scheme for using them. And it was not, after the first moment, the horror of the idea that held her spellbound, subdued to his will. It was rather its subtle affinity to her own inmost cravings. He would marry her tomorrow, if she could regain Bertha Dorset's friendship, and to induce the open resumption of that friendship, and the tacit retractation of all that had caused its withdrawal, as he had only to put to the lady the latent menace contained in the packet so miraculously delivered into her hands. Lily saw in a flash the advantage of this course over that which poor Dorset had pressed upon her. The other plan depended for its success on the infliction of an open injury, while this reduced the transaction to a private understanding, of which no third person need have the remotest hint. Put by Rosedale in terms of business-like give and take, this understanding took on the harmless air of a mutual accommodation, like a transfer of property or a revision of boundary lines. It certainly simplified life. To view it as a perpetual adjustment, a play of party politics, in which every concession had its recognized equivalent. Lily's tired mind was fascinated by this escape from fluctuating ethical estimates into a region of concrete weights and measures. Rosedale, as she listened, seemed to read in her silence not only a gradual acquiescence in his plan, but a dangerously far-reaching perception of the chances it offered. For as she continued to stand before him without speaking, he broke out, with a quick return upon himself, "You see how simple it is, don't you? Well, don't be carried away by the idea that it's too simple. It isn't exactly as if you'd started in with a clean bill of health. Now we're talking, let's call things by their right names, and clear the whole business up. You know well enough that Bertha Dorset couldn't have touched you if there hadn't been well questions asked before, little points of interrogation, eh? Bound to happen to a good-looking girl with stingy relatives, I suppose. Anyhow, they did happen, and she found the ground prepared for her. Do you see where I'm coming out? You don't want these little questions cropping up again. It's one thing to get Bertha Dorset into line, but what you want is to keep her there. You can frighten her fast enough, but how are you going to keep her frightened? By showing her that you're as powerful as she is. All the letters in the world won't do that for you as you are now, but with a big backing behind you, you'll keep her just where you want her to be. That's my share in the business, that's what I'm offering you. You can't put the thing through without me, don't run away with any idea that you can. In 6 months you'd be back again among your old worries, or worse ones, and here I am, ready to lift you out of them tomorrow, if you say so. Do you say so, Miss Lily? He added, moving suddenly nearer. The words, and the movement which accompanied them, combined to startle Lily out of the state of tranced subservience into which he had insensibly slipped. Light comes in devious ways to the groping consciousness, and it came to her now through the disgusted perception that her would-be accomplice assumed, as a matter of course, the likelihood of her distrusting him, and perhaps trying to cheat him of his share of the spoils. This glimpse of his inner mind seemed to present the whole transaction in a new aspect, and she saw that the essential baseness of the act lay in its freedom from risk. She drew back with a quick gesture of rejection, saying, in a voice that was a surprise to her own ears, "You are mistaken, quite mistaken, both in the facts and in what you infer from them." Rosedale stared a moment, puzzled by her sudden dash in a direction so different from that toward which he had appeared to be letting him guide her. "Now what on earth does that mean? I thought we understood each other," he exclaimed. "And to her murmur of, H, we do now," he retorted with a sudden burst of violence, "I suppose it's because the letters are to him, then? Well, I'll be damned if I see what thanks you've got from him." The autumn days declined to winter. Once more the leisure world was in transition between country and town, and Fifth Avenue, still deserted at the weekend, showed from Monday to Friday a broadening stream of carriages between house fronts gradually restored to consciousness. The horse show, some 2 weeks earlier, had produced a passing semblance of reanimation, filling the theaters and restaurants with a human display of the same costly and high-stepping kind as circled daily about its ring. In Miss Bart's world, the horse show, and the public it attracted, had ostensibly come to be classed among the spectacles disdained of the elect, but, as the feudal lord might sally forth to join in the dance on his village green, so society, unofficially and incidentally, still condescended to look in upon the scene. Mrs. Gormer, among the rest, was not above seizing such an occasion for the display of herself and her horses, and Lily was given one or two opportunities of appearing at her friend's side in the most conspicuous box the house afforded. But this lingering semblance of intimacy made her only the more conscious of a change in the relation between Maddie and herself, of a dawning discrimination, a gradually formed social standard, emerging from Mrs. Gormer's chaotic view of life. It was inevitable that Lily herself should constitute the first sacrifice to this new ideal, and she knew that, once the Gormers were established in town, the whole drift of fashionable life would facilitate Maddie's detachment from her, as he had, in short, failed to make herself indispensable, or rather, her attempt to do so had been thwarted by an influence stronger than any she could exert. That influence, in its last analysis, was simply the power of money. Bertha Dorset's social credit was based on an impregnable bank account. Lily knew that Rosedale had overstated neither the difficulty of her own position, nor the completeness of the vindication he offered. Once Bertha's match in material resources, her superior gifts would make it easy for her to dominate her adversary. An understanding of what such domination would mean, and of the disadvantages accruing from her rejection of it, was brought home to Lily with increasing clearness during the early weeks of the winter. Hitherto, as he had kept up a semblance of movement outside the main flow of the social current, but with the return to town, and the concentrating of scattered activities, the mere fact of not slipping back naturally into her old habits of life marked her as being unmistakably excluded from them. If one were not a part of the season's fixed routine, one swung unspurred in a void of social non-existence. Lily, for all her dissatisfied dreaming, had never really conceived the possibility of revolving about a different center. It was easy enough to despise the world, but decidedly difficult to find any other habitable region. Her sense of irony never quite deserted her, and she could still note, with self-directed derision, the abnormal value suddenly acquired by the most tiresome and insignificant details of her former life. Its very drudgeries had a charm now that she was involuntarily released from them. Card leaving, note writing, enforced civilities to the dull and elderly, and the smiling endurance of tedious dinners, how pleasantly such obligations would have filled the emptiness of her days. She did indeed leave cards in plenty. She kept herself, with a smiling and valiant persistence, well in the eye of her world, nor did she suffer any of those gross rebuffs which sometimes produce a wholesome reaction of contempt in their victim. Society did not turn away from her, it simply drifted by, preoccupied and inattentive, letting her feel, to the full measure of her humbled pride, how completely S.E. had been the creature of its favor. S.E. had rejected Rosedale's suggestion with a promptness of scorn almost surprising to herself. S.E. had not lost her capacity for high flashes of indignation. But she could not breathe long on the heights. There had been nothing in her training to develop any continuity of moral strength. What she craved, and really felt herself entitled to, was a situation in which the noblest attitude should also be the easiest. Hitherto her intermittent impulses of resistance had sufficed to maintain her self-respect. If she slipped, she recovered her footing, and it was only afterward that she was aware of having recovered it each time on a slightly lower level. As he had rejected Rosedale's offer without conscious effort, her whole being had risen against it, and she did not yet perceive that, by the mere act of listening to him, as he had learned to live with ideas which would once have been intolerable to her. To Gertie Farish, keeping watch over her with a tenderer, if less discerning eye than Mrs. Fisher's, the results of the struggle were already distinctly visible. She did not, indeed, know what hostages Lily had already given to expediency, but she saw her passionately and irretrievably pledged to the ruinous policy of keeping up. Gertie could smile now at her own early dream of her friend's renovation through adversity. She understood clearly enough that Lily was not of those to whom privation teaches the unimportance of what they have lost. But this very fact, to Gertie, made her friend the more piteously in want of aid, the more exposed to the claims of a tenderness she was so little conscious of needing. Lily, since her return to town, had not often climbed Miss Farish's stairs. There was something irritating to her in the mute interrogation of Gertie's sympathy. She felt the real difficulties of her situation, to be incommunicable to anyone whose theory of values was so different from her own, and the restrictions of Gertie's life, which had once had the charm of contrast, now reminded her too painfully of the limits to which her own existence was shrinking. When at length, one afternoon, she put into execution the belated resolve to visit her friend, this sense of shrunken opportunities possessed her with unusual intensity. The walk up Fifth Avenue, unfolding before her, in the brilliance of the hard winter sunlight, an interminable procession of fastidiously equipped carriages giving her, through the little squares of brougham windows, peeps of familiar profiles bent above visiting lists, of hurried hands dispensing notes and cards to attendant footmen, this glimpse of the ever-revolving wheels of the great social machine made Lily more than ever conscious of the steepness and narrowness of dirty stairs, and of the cramped blind alley of life to which they led. Dull stairs destined to be mounted by dull people. How many thousands of insignificant figures were going up and down such stairs all over the world at that very moment, figures as shabby and uninteresting as that of the middle-aged lady in limp black who descended Gertie's flight as Lily climbed to it. That was poor Miss Jane Silverton. She came to talk things over with me. She and her sister want to do something to support themselves, Gertie explained, as Lily followed her into the sitting room. To support themselves? Are they so hard up? Miss Bart asked with a touch of irritation. As he had not come to listen to the woes of other people. I'm afraid they have nothing left. Ned's debts have swallowed up everything. They had such hopes, you know, when he broke away from Carrie Fisher. They thought Bertha Dorset would be such a good influence, because she doesn't care for cards, and well, she talked quite beautifully to poor Miss Jane about feeling as if Ned were her younger brother, and wanting to carry him off on the yacht, so that he might have a chance to drop cards and racing, and take up his literary work again. Miss Farish paused with a sigh which reflected the perplexity of her departing visitor. But that isn't all. It isn't even the worst. It seems that Ned has quarreled with the Dorsets, or at least Bertha won't allow him to see her, and he is so unhappy about it that he has taken to gambling again, and going about with all sorts of queer people. And cousin Grace Van Osburgh accuses him of having had a very bad influence on Freddie, who left Harvard last spring, and has been a great deal with Ned ever since. She sent for Miss Jane, and made a dreadful scene. And Jack Stepney and Herbert Melson, who were there too, told Miss Jane that Freddie was threatening to marry some dreadful woman to whom Ned had introduced him, and that they could do nothing with him, because now he's of age he has his own money. You can fancy how poor Miss Jane felt. She came to me at once, and seemed to think that, if I could get her something to do, she could earn enough to pay Ned's debts, and send him away. I'm afraid as he has no idea how long it would take her to pay for one of his evenings at bridge. And he was horribly in debt when he came back from the cruise. I can't see why he should have spent so much more money under Bertha's influence than Carrie's. Can you? Lily met this query with an impatient gesture. My dear Gertie, I always understand how people can spend much more money, never how they can spend any less. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.